You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.
Welcome to the Daily Nationalist. Today's date is Tuesday the 10th of March 2020 and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, broadcasting at RadioAlbion.com. Well, there's not really that much news to get into today. It all seems to have been taken over by coronavirus, and I'll leave that to the mainstream publications to talk about. But something that I did bring up yesterday was about blacks and their language and what we can learn from their language in Africa about the way that they think and the number of words that they actually have to describe things, which shows their thought processes. Now, I've mentioned this before, and where I'm getting this from is from a chap called Professor Eugene Valberg. And it's from a particular YouTube video, which is called African Language in the African Mind. And it's actually from a conference speech that he gave at the American Renaissance Conference called Understanding the African Mind. And he's actually written a book as well, which is apparently pretty good. But this conference speech that he gave, it was talking about 30 years worth of research that he's done. And I thought what we'd go into today is just a little bit of details about him and the speech, and then I'll read out some quotes from him. And this is what American Renaissance have to say about him. Dr. Valberg is an American philosopher who has lived for nearly 30 years in Africa. His observations have led him to surprising conclusions about what Africans think about themselves and whites. And I found a blog post where somebody was questioning some of Dr. Valberg's conclusions, and I've taken a few quotes from there because it gives us a good overview of what he was talking about at this conference. At the conference, Dr. Eugene Valberg spoke about African languages. Having spent many years in Africa and being a particularly bright individual, Dr. Valberg is certainly more qualified than most to speak on this subject. The main points that he made were as follows. A. Native African languages have very limited vocabularies. He recounted how native Africans expressed wonder that a speaker of English would ever need an English dictionary. He seemed to be saying that this is, at least in part, a reflection of the simplicity of the African mind. As I remember, this was strongly implied, if not stated explicitly. B. Native African languages lack words for abstract concepts. Instead, they borrow words for concrete ideas and clumsily use them to approximate abstract concepts that more advanced peoples had introduced into Africa. One example is the word obligation, which one African language attempts to convey through the words to tie together one's feet. C. African languages do not include terms of precision. For example, there is typically no way to say the fruit is halfway up the tree. Either it is up the tree or it is not. This is a product of the African mind seeing things in absolutes. And then the author comes up with two instances that confirm this. I recently met a gentleman who is from southern Sudan, near Uganda. He is a speaker of Kuku, so I availed myself of the opportunity to get his perspective on the above questions. First, I asked him how many words, excluding recent foreign loan words, are in Kuku. He guessed that Kuku has around 1,000 words and that there is no need for a Kuku dictionary for native speakers. On this count, he was in agreement with Dr. Valberg, although he would probably disagree with his explanation. I asked the man about expressing the concept of a fruit being only three quarters up a tree. This question took him off guard, and his response led me to concede this point to Dr. Valberg. He explained to me that in cuckoo, one cannot state that a glass is only partly full. Either it has contents, or it does not. Cuckoo speakers have no concept of fractions. So there we have a couple of confirmations that what Dr. Valberg was talking about was true. And now I've got a rather long quote from the speech that he gave. And this is Dr. Eugene Valberg's speech. It has long seemed to me that blacks tend to lack self-awareness. If such awareness is necessary for developing abstract concepts, it is not surprising that African languages have so few abstract terms. A lack of self-awareness or introspection has advantages. In my experience, neurotic behavior, characterized by excessive and unhealthy self-consciousness, is uncommon among blacks. I am also confident that sexual dysfunction, which is characterized by excessive self-consciousness, is less common among blacks than whites. Time is another abstract concept with which Africans seem to have difficulties. I began to wonder about this in 1998. Several Africans drove up in a car and parked right in front of mine, blocking it. "Hey," I said, "you can't park here." "Oh, are you about to leave?" they asked, in a perfectly polite and friendly way. "No," I said, "but I might later. Park over there." And they did. While the possibility that I might want to leave later was obvious to me, their thinking seemed to encompass only the here and now. "If you're leaving right now, we understand, but otherwise, what's the problem?" I had other such encounters, and the key question always seemed to be, "Are you leaving now?" The future, after all, does not exist. It will exist, but it doesn't exist right now. People who have difficulty thinking of things that do not exist will ipso facto have difficulty thinking about the future. It appears that the Zulu word for future, isikati, is the same as the word for time, as well as for space. Realistically, this means that these concepts probably do not exist in Zulu thought. It also appears that there is no word for the past, meaning the time preceding the present. The past did exist, but it no longer exists. Hence, people who may have problems thinking of things that do not exist will have trouble thinking of the past as well as the future. This has an obvious bearing on such sentiments as gratitude and loyalty, which I have long noticed are uncommon among Africans. We feel gratitude for things that happened in the past, but for those with little sense of the past, such feelings are less likely to arise. Why did it take me more than 20 years to notice all of this? I think it is because our assumptions about time are so deeply rooted that we are not even aware of making them, and hence the possibility that others may not share them simply does not occur to us, and so we don't see it, even when the evidence is staring us in the face. And now he talks a bit about mathematics and maintenance. I quote from an article in the South African Press about the problems blacks have with mathematics. Xhosa is a language where polygon and plane have the same definition, where concepts like triangle, quadrilateral, pentagon, hexagon are defined by only one word. That comes from Finding New Languages for Maths and Science from the Johannesburg Star, July 24, 2002. More accurately, these concepts simply do not exist in Xhosa, which, along with Zulu, is one of the two most widely spoken languages in South Africa. In America, blacks are said to have a, quote, tendency to approximate space, numbers, and time instead of aiming for complete accuracy, close quote. And again, that comes from the Star. In other words, they are also poor at maths. Notice the identical triumvirate, space, numbers, and time. Is it just a coincidence that these three highly abstract concepts are the ones with which blacks everywhere seem to have such difficulties? The entry in the Zulu dictionary for number, by the way, ningi, means numerous, which is not at all the same as the concept of number. It is clear, therefore, that there is no concept of number in Zulu. White rule in South Africa ended in 1994. It was about 10 years later that power outages began, which eventually reached crisis proportions. The principal reason for this is simply lack of maintenance on the generating equipment. Maintenance is future-oriented, and the Zulu entry in the dictionary for it is ongla, which means to nourish, rear, bring up, or to keep an eye on, watch, your crop. In short, there is no such thing as maintenance in Zulu thought, and it would be hard to argue that this is wholly unrelated to the fact that when people throughout Africa say, nothing works, it is only an exaggeration. The New York Times reports that New York City is considering a plan, which has since been implemented, aimed at getting blacks to do well on standardized tests and to show up for class, by paying them to do these things, and that could earn them as much as $500 a year. Students would get money for regular school attendance, every book they read, doing well on tests, and sometimes just for taking them. Parents would be paid for keeping a full-time job, having health insurance, and attending parent-teacher conferences. And that comes from Schools Plan to Pay Cash for Marks from the New York Times, June 19, 2007. The clear implication is that blacks are not very motivated. Motivation involves thinking about the future, and hence about things that do not exist. Given black deficiencies in this regard, it is not surprising that they would be lacking in motivation, and having to prod them in this way is further evidence for such a deficiency. The Zulu entry for motivate is banga, under which we read 1. Make, cause, produce something unpleasant, to cause trouble. 2. Contend over a claim, fight over inheritance. 3. Make for, aim at, journey towards. Yet when I ask Africans what banga means, they have no idea. In fact, no Zulu word could refer to motivation for the simple reason that there is no such concept in Zulu. And if there is no such concept, there cannot be a word for it. This helps explain the need to pay blacks to behave as if they were motivated. The same New York Times article quotes Darwin Davis of the Urban League as cautioning that the money being offered for attending class was relatively paltry, and wondering how many tests students would need to pass to buy the latest video game. Instead of being shamed by the very need for such a plan, this black activist complains that the payments are not enough. If he really is unaware how his remarks will strike most readers, he is morally obtuse. But his views may reflect a common understanding among blacks of what morality is, not something internalized, but something others enforce from the outside. Hence his complaint that paying children to do things they should be motivated to do on their own is that they are not being paid enough. In this context, I recall some remarkable discoveries by the late American linguist William Stewart, who spent many years in Senegal studying local languages. Whereas Western cultures internalize norms, don't do that, for a child eventually becomes, I mustn't do that, for an adult. African cultures do not. They rely entirely on external controls on behavior, from tribal elders and other sources of authority. When Africans were detribalized, these external constraints disappeared, and since there were never any internal constraints, the results were crime, drugs, and promiscuity. Where there have been other forms of control, as in white-ruled South Africa, colonial Africa, or the segregated American South, this behavior was kept within tolerable limits. But when even these controls disappear, there is often unbridled violence. Stewart apparently never asked why African cultures did not internalize norms. That is, why they never developed moral consciousness. But it is unlikely that this was just a historical accident. More likely, it was the result of deficiencies in abstract thinking ability. One explanation for this lack of abstract thinking, including the diminished understanding of time, is that Africans evolved in a climate where they could live day to day without having to think ahead. They never developed this ability, because they had no need for it. Whites, on the other hand, evolved under circumstances in which they had to consider what would happen if they didn't build stout houses and store enough fuel and food for the winter. For them, it was sink or swim. Surprising confirmation of Stewart's ideas can be found in the May-June 2006 issue of the Boston Review, a typically liberal publication. In Do the Right Thing, Cognitive Science's Search for a Common Morality, Rebecca Sachs distinguishes between conventional and moral rules. Conventional rules are supported by authorities, but can be changed. Moral rules, on the other hand, are not based on conventional authority and are not subject to change. Even three-year-old children distinguish between moral and conventional transgressions, she writes. The only exception, according to James Blair of the National Institutes of Health, are psychopaths, who exhibit persistent aggressive behaviour. For them, all rules are based only on external authority, in whose absence anything is permissible. The conclusion drawn from this is that healthy individuals in all cultures respect the distinction between conventional and moral rules. However, in the same article, another anthropologist argues that the special status of moral rules cannot be a part of human nature, but is just an artifact of Western values. Anita Jacobson-Widding, writing of her experience among the Manyika of Zimbabwe, says, "I tried to find a word that would correspond to the English concept of morality. I explained what I meant by asking my informants to describe the norms for good behaviour towards other people. The answer was unanimous. The word for this was sika. But when I asked my bilingual informants to translate sika into English, they said that it was good manners." She concluded that because good manners are clearly conventional rather than moral rules, the Manyika simply did not have a concept of morality. But how could one explain this absence? Miss Jacobson-Widding's explanation is the typical nonsense that could come only from a so-called intellectual. The concept of morality does not exist. The far more likely explanation is that the concept of morality, while otherwise universal, is enfeebled in cultures that have a deficiency in abstract thinking. According to now discredited folk wisdom, blacks are children in adult bodies, but there may be some foundation to this view. The average African adult has the raw IQ score of the average 11-year-old white child. This is about the age at which white children begin to internalize morality and no longer need such strong external enforcers. Another aspect of African behavior that liberals do their best to ignore, but that nevertheless requires an explanation, is gratuitous cruelty. A reviewer of Driving South, a 1993 book by David Robbins, writes, "A Cape social worker sees elements that revel in violence. It's like a cult which has embraced a lot of people who otherwise appear normal. At the slightest provocation, their bloodlust is aroused, and then they want to see death, and they jeer and mock at the suffering involved, especially the suffering of a slow and agonizing death." There is something so unspeakably vile about this, something so beyond depravity, that the human brain recoils. This is not merely the absence of human empathy, but the positive enjoyment of human suffering, all the more so when it is slow and agonizing. Can you imagine jeering and mocking someone in such horrible agony? During the apartheid era, black activists used to kill traitors and enemies by necklacing them. An old tire was put around the victim's neck, filled with gasoline, and, but here it is best to let an eyewitness describe what happened next. The petrol-filled tire is jammed on your shoulders and a lighter is placed within reach. Your fingers are broken, needles are pushed up your nose, and you are tortured until you put the lighter to the petrol yourself. And that's a quote from Citizen Essays New Nazis, August 10th, 1993. The author of an article in the Chicago Tribune describing the equally gruesome way the Hutu killed the Tutsi in the Burundi massacres marvelled at the ecstasy of killing, the lust for blood, This is the most horrible thought. It is beyond my reach. And that's from Hutu Killers Danced in Blood of Victims videotapes show from the Chicago Tribune. The lack of any moral sense is further evidenced by their having videotaped their own crimes, apparently wanting to record them for posterity. Unlike, quote-unquote, Nazi war criminals who hid their deeds, these people apparently took pride in their work. So he's obviously someone who believes in the gas chambers and the 6 million. In 1993, Amy Blale, a 26-year-old American on a Fulbright scholarship, was living in South Africa, where she spent most of her time in black townships helping blacks. One day, when she was driving three African friends home, young blacks stopped the car, dragged her out, and killed her because she was white. A retired senior South African judge, Rex von Schalowick, in his 1998 book One Miracle Is Not Enough, quotes from a newspaper report on the trial of her killers. Supporters of the three men accused of murdering her burst out laughing in the public gallery of the Supreme Court today when a witness told how the battered woman groaned in pain. This behaviour, von Schalwick wrote, is impossible to explain in terms accessible to rational minds. These incidents and the responses they evoke, the human brain recoils, beyond my reach, impossible to explain to rational minds, represent a pattern of behaviour and thinking that cannot be wished away, and offer additional support for my claim that Africans are deficient in moral consciousness. I have long suspected that the idea of rape is not the same in Africa as elsewhere, and now I find confirmation of this in Newsweek. According to a 3-year study in Johannesburg, more than half of the young people interviewed, both male and female, believe that forcing sex with someone you know does not constitute sexual violence. The casual manner in which South African teens discuss coercive relationships and unprotected sex is staggering. That's from Breaking the Silence, Newsweek, July 9th, 2000. Clearly, many blacks do not think rape is anything to be ashamed of. The Newsweek author is puzzled by widespread behaviour that is known to lead to AIDS, asking, why has the safe sex effort failed so abjectly? Well, aside from their profoundly different attitudes towards sex and violence and their heightened libido, a major factor could be their diminished concept of time and reduced ability to think ahead. Nevertheless, I was still surprised by what I found in the Zulu dictionary. The main entry for rape reads, 1. Act hurriedly. 2. Be greedy. 3. Rob. Plunder. Take possessions by force. While these entries may be related to our concept of rape, there is one small problem. There is no reference to sexual intercourse. In a male-dominated culture where saying no is often not an option, as confirmed by the study just mentioned, taking sex by force is not really part of the African mental calculus. Rape clearly has a moral dimension, but perhaps not to Africans, to the extent that they do not consider coerced sex to be wrong. Then by our conception, they cannot consider it rape because rape is wrong. If such behaviour isn't wrong, it isn't rape. An article about gang rape in the left-wing British paper The Guardian confirms this when it quotes a young black woman. The thing is, they, black men, don't see it as rape, as us being forced, they just see it as pleasure for them. That was by Rose George. They don't see it as rape, they just see it as a pleasure for them. June 5th, 2004. A similar attitude seems to be shared among some American blacks, who casually refer to gang rape as running a train. From Nathan McCall, Makes Me Wanna Holler, Vintage Books, 1995. If the African understanding of rape is far afield, so may be their idea of romance or love. I recently watched a South African television program about having sex for money. Of the several women in the audience who spoke up, not a single one questioned the morality of this behaviour. Indeed, one plaintively asked, "Why else would I have sex with a man?" From the casual way in which Africans throw around the word love, I suspect their understanding of it is at best childish, I suspect the notion is alien to Africans, and I would be surprised if things are very different among American blacks. Africans hear whites speak of love and try to give it a meaning from within their own conceptual repertoire. The result is a child's conception of this deepest of human emotions, probably similar to their misunderstanding of the nature of a promise. I recently located a document that was dictated to me by a young African woman in June 1993. She called it her story, and the final paragraph is a poignant illustration of what to Europeans would seem to be a limited understanding of love. On my way from school, I met a boy, and he proposed to me. His name was Makoni. He tell me that he loved me, and then I tell him I will give him his answer next week. At night, I was crazy about him. I was always thinking about him. And then he moves on to moral blindness. Whenever I taught ethics, I used the example of Alfred Dreyfus, a Jewish officer in the French army who was convicted of treason in 1894, even though the authorities knew he was innocent. Admitting their mistake, it was said, would have a disastrous effect on military morale and would cause great social unrest. I would in turn argue that certain things are intrinsically wrong and not just because of their consequences. Even if the results of freeing Dreyfus would be much worse than keeping him in prison, he must be freed because it is unjust to keep an innocent man in prison. To my amazement, an entire class in Kenya said without hesitation that he should not be freed. Call me dense if you want, but it was 20 years before the full significance of this began to dawn upon me. Africans, I believe, may generally lack the concepts of subjunctivity and counterfactuality. Subjunctivity is conveyed in such statements as, "What would you have done if I hadn't showed up?" This is contrary to fact, because I did show up, and it is now impossible for me not to have shown up. We are asking someone to imagine what he would have done if something that didn't happen and now couldn't happen had happened. This requires self-consciousness, and I have already described blacks' possible deficiency in this respect. It is obvious that animals, for example, cannot think counterfactually because of their complete lack of self-awareness. When someone I know tried to persuade his African workers to contribute to a health insurance policy, they asked, "What is it for?" "Well, if you have an accident, it would pay for the hospital." Their response was immediate. "But boss, we didn't have an accident." "Yes, but what if you did?" Reply, "We didn't have an accident." End of story. Interestingly, blacks do plan for funerals. For although an accident is only a risk, death is a certainty. The Zulu entries for risk are danger and a slippery surface. Given the frequent all-or-nothing nature of black thinking, if it is not certain you will have an accident, then you will not have an accident. Furthermore, death is concrete and observable. We see people grow old and die. Africans tend to be aware of time when it is manifested in the concrete and observable. One of the pivotal ideas underpinning morality is the golden rule: do unto others as you would have them do unto you. How would you feel if someone stole everything you owned? Well, that's how he would feel if you robbed him. This subjunctivity here is obvious. But if Africans may generally lack this concept, they will have difficulty in understanding the golden rule, and to that extent in understanding morality. If this is true, we might also expect their capacity for human empathy to be diminished, and this is suggested in the examples cited earlier. After all, how do we empathize? When we hear about things like necklacing, we instinctively and unconsciously think, how would I feel if I were that person? Of course, I am not and cannot be that person, but to imagine being that person gives us valuable moral information that we wouldn't want this to happen to us, and so we shouldn't want it to happen to others. To the extent people are deficient in such abstract thinking, they will be deficient in moral understanding, and hence in human empathy, which is what we tend to find in Africans. In his 1990 book Devil's Night, Ziev Shafetz quotes a black woman speaking about the problems of Detroit. "I know some people won't like this, but whenever you get a whole lot of black people, you're gonna have problems. Blacks are ignorant and rude." If some Africans cannot clearly imagine what their own rude behavior feels like to others, in other words, if they cannot put themselves in the other person's shoes, they will be incapable of understanding what rudeness is. For them, what we call rude may be normal, and therefore, from their perspective, not really rude. Africans may therefore not be offended by behavior we would consider rude, not keeping appointments, for example. One might even conjecture that African cruelty is not the same as white cruelty, since Africans may not be fully aware of the nature of their behavior, whereas such awareness is an essential part of real cruelty. I am hardly the only one to notice this obliviousness to others that sometimes characterizes black behavior. Walt Harrington, a white liberal married to a light-skinned black, makes some surprising admissions in his 1994 book Crossings: A White Man's Journey into Black America. "I noticed a small car in the distance. Suddenly, a bag of garbage flies out of its window. I think, I bet they're blacks. Over the years, I've noticed more blacks littering than whites. I hate to admit this, because it is a prejudice. But as I pass the car, I see that my reflex was correct. They are blacks. As I pull into a McDonald's drive-thru, I see that the car in front of me had four blacks in it. Again, my mind made its unconscious calculation. We'll be sitting here forever while these people decide what to order. I literally shook my head. My God, my kids are half black. But then the kicker. We waited and waited and waited. Each of the four leaned out the window and ordered individually. The order was changed several times. We sat and sat, and I again shook my head, this time at the conundrum that is race in America. I knew that the buried sentiment that had made me predict this disorganization was racist, but my prediction was right." Africans also tend to litter. To understand this, we must ask why whites don't litter, at least not as much. We ask ourselves, what would happen if everyone threw rubbish everywhere? It would be a mess, so you shouldn't do it. Blacks' possible deficiency in abstract thinking makes such reasoning more difficult, so any behavior requiring such thinking is less likely to develop in their cultures. Even after living for generations in societies where such thinking is commonplace, many may still fail to absorb it. It should go without saying that my observations about Africans are generalizations. I am not saying that none has the capacity for abstract thought or moral understanding. I am speaking of tendencies and averages, which leave room for many exceptions. To what extent do my observations about Africans apply to American blacks? American blacks have an average IQ of 85, which is a full 15 points higher than the African average of 70. The capacity for abstract thought is unquestionably correlated with intelligence, and so we can expect American blacks generally to exceed Africans in these respects. Still, American blacks show many of the traits so striking among Africans: low mathematical ability, diminished abstract reasoning, high crime rates, a short time horizon, rudeness, littering, and other things. If I had lived only among American blacks and not among Africans, I might never have reached the conclusions I have. But the more extreme behavior among Africans makes it easier to perceive the same tendencies among American blacks. And that's the end of his speech there. And he has a book which is called Racism, Guilt, Self-Hatred, and Self-Deceit, but it's written by an alter ego, Gedaliah Braun, and his real name is Professor Eugene Valberg. And I think that really does explain a lot of the ways that we see blacks behaving, and that gives us an explanation for it. And we can't judge them by our own standards, because they are a different people and they have different standards, which is why when we mix with them in these multicultural experiments, we have so many problems because we expect them to be just the same as us, and they expect us to be just the same as them. And that just isn't reality. Well, thank you very much for listening. I will be back tomorrow with more of the Daily Nationalist. God bless and hail victory.
You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.